countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt in, opt in. Go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. And it is Saturday, the 8th of July in the glorious future year of 2023. This is going to be the last A Step Farther Out show for a while, because Thursday I am leaving here to go to Manitoba for the North American Science Fiction Convention, which is being held in Winnipeg the 20th through the 23rd of July. And I'm going to be busy during the convention. I'm also going to be, before and after the convention, staying with a friend at his place on the beach, in Grand Beach, Grand Marais, on the shore of Lake Winnipeg. And there's no internet connection there. I'll have to go into town to the community center, probably daily to check my email. I wouldn't want to go daily, but going up to the convention, since I have things to do with the convention, obviously I need to remain at least somewhat in touch. Can't just be out of touch the whole time. Afterwards, however, I'll probably not do it that frequently. And as you can imagine, in the lead-up to the convention, I'm quite busy, which means that I won't have much time to put together pre-recorded shows. So it'll either be the Auto Archive bot serving you up warmed over selections from the past, or it'll be something else entirely, such as things off of LPs, because I can prepare those more rapidly and just dump those into a playlist and make a file, upload that file, probably even from the somewhat iffy, probably wireless internet connection at the community center, and then, you know, but yeah, I won't be available. Unlike at the WesterCon last year in Tonopah, where I actually did a live show from the convention floor, I doubt that will be feasible in this case. I don't actually know at this point whether we're going to have any kind of internet service in the RBC Center, but I really doubt that it'll be wired. And I've found that wireless connections just aren't stable enough to do to icecast from, basically. So that's the that's sort of the story as far as that goes. Anyway, I'll be back on the 9th. So let's see. Looking at the calendar. So I'm departing. So there'll be a Hear Now the Words show on the 11th of this month. And then after that, the next show you can expect from me is actually on the 11th of next month. So yeah, there's going to be which is a Friday. So yeah, there's going to be a gap. I'm just telling you now. But yeah, so I'm looking forward to the beach. My friend goes sailing for 4 or 6 weeks every summer. And he's been saying for years that he wants me to come up and join him in the summer. And now with the Worldcon being in Winnipeg, with the NASFIC rather being in Winnipeg, they were bidding for the Worldcon. But with the NASFIC being in Winnipeg, you know, that's, it's a perfect opportunity. So I'm going to Grand Forks, North Dakota, and he'll pick me up there. Now, here's the thing. I'm going to talk about transportation a little bit. If you tuned into Hear Now the Words yesterday, pretty much the first half of the show was my complaining about transportation, and more particularly about the fact that I wound up having to take an air flight to Grand Forks because of Amtrak's continued refusal to sell me a ticket from an origin point, which is served by Amtrak, to a destination point, which is served by Amtrak. You know, I should be able to get on the Texas Eagle here in Fort Worth, take it to Chicago, change it to Chicago for the Empire Builder, which goes towards Portland and Seattle. Well, the first thing is, although the Texas Eagle arrives nominally in Chicago before the Empire Builder departs westward, the on-time performance is so poor that they say, well, we won't book a ticket like that. You know, you'll have to stay over in Chicago at your own expense and take the next day's train. Jesus Christ. And then, well, even when I said, okay, I'll do it, you know, the clerk was looking at it. She says, I don't know. I can see it, but I can't book it. The services are pretty much 100% full up every day. Any other operator of transport services would say, hey, maybe we should add an extra sleeping car. Maybe we should add an extra coach car. Maybe we should run more trains. Amtrak does not. The idea of increasing service to meet demand is utterly alien to their management. They have no concept that if people are demanding a service, you should provide it to them in exchange for money. It's pretty amazing. Pretty darn amazing. When I think about transport, one of the things that I think about a lot is the way that steel wheel on steel rail with electric current delivered from overhead wire scales admirably well. It scales from almost neighborhood size to continental scale with surprising ease. You know, in the first part of the 20th century in America, before the big automobile boom, towns as small as 5 or even 3,000 population had electrified street railways, steel wheel on steel rail with overhead wire. And it was a really convenient way for people to get around. And you can just keep scaling that technique up. It's amazing. It scales like nothing else I'm aware of. You know, you can't possibly, you know, people are trying to introduce air taxis, which will take you from one side of town to the other. And all of them, I mean, I won't say it can't possibly be done, but none of them is very attractive. And then, as far as crossing the country by road vehicle, I mean, have you ever taken the Greyhound any long distance? I mean, forget about driving. Driving long distances is pure misery. You do it because you've got a load to haul or something, right? Not because you enjoy it. Very few people enjoy doing that to themselves. I mean, there's bound to be one or two, but very few. People mostly drive long distances because they feel like they can't get where they're going any other way, or where they need to get to their destination. They're going to need a car, and so the cheapest way to provide it is just to drive their own car the long distance, because car rentals are expensive and can be difficult to get. But the whole road transportation thing just doesn't scale all that well. Particularly, you know, you think about freight equally, right? Freight, I mean, you have these railroads which are pushing for one-person operation of trains. Well, direct labor costs, train operators, are not their big problem, right? Three-person operation with a locomotive driver and two brakemen would be perfectly economical, considering that a typical container train, for example, has, let's say, 250 containers sometimes 300, sometimes more. And the typical tractor-trailer rig hauls one, maybe two containers, right? One, sometimes two. So you're talking about the difference between two to three people to operate a train, which carries, let's say, 250 containers, and 200 people to drive that stuff by road freight. You know, forget about the wear and tear on the road, which trains impose much less wear and tear on their roadbed, and the maintenance is much easier, right? Heavy trucks tear up roadways. Everybody knows this. But just looking at direct labor costs, trains provide an amazing scale, right? Economy of scale. Similarly, I mean, as you know, I'm no friend of coal trains. But if you look at coal trains, you realize immediately, this is a 100 or 120 car string of cars, each containing 100 to 120 tons of coal, which, you know, each car load is equivalent to 2 to 3 truckloads easily. And so you're talking about anywhere from 200 to 350 or so truckloads. And you look at the fuel costs as well as the direct labor costs, and it rapidly becomes obvious that if trucks were the only way to transport coal, you would not have long-distance transport of coal. It's just infeasible. Anyway, so, you know, this is very interesting to me. You know, I don't believe in air taxis. I don't enjoy scheduled commercial air travel. This is the thing. I have nothing against flying. I'm not a person who has a fear of flying. I have, however, a dread of scheduled commercial air travel. It's a really unenjoyable experience for me. And I don't trust these people who are trying to build great big beefed-up versions of little pocket quadcopters or hexacopters. I mean, you know, you've got these things with, oh, it's got 18 electric motors and 18 rotors and a really complex control system and what? Is the question. And what? I have, of course, considerable distrust for a lot of the so-called innovation today. A great example of this was on the front cover of the Wall Street Journal the other day. No, it's a second section of the Wall Street Journal, I think. Anyway, but it emphasized to me, you know, I've been saying the so-called AI thing. Firstly, linear language models are not equivalent in any way, shape, or form to artificial intelligence. But the bigger question is, what's the scam? Right? Because this is the thing. It's clearly a scam. You can tell it's a scam because it's being pushed by the same people who pushed previous scams. And the article was not about what we think this stuff is going to do. The article was all about, oh, good, here's something to keep the churn and burn machine going. Here's something to push up valuations in the tech sector, which you begin to flag. Again, the so-called tech sector is defined not by having any technology. I mean, steel mills are technology, right? They don't get called the tech sector. No, the so-called tech sector is defined by having growth. Its only product is growth. In other words, it is a bubble. And so the thing is to keep pushing the bubble, not to do anything useful in the real world, but to keep making the noises that keep funneling the money. And this article was pretty explicit about that, to be honest. You know, everybody's heaving a big sigh of relief because here's a new thing to keep the churn and burn machine going. That's really all it's about. It's fascinating. You know, the real economy, wealth created in the real economy keeps getting siphoned off. And the things that do the siphoning off, everybody talks about how they're great. I've in fact seen it suggested that when inequality is decreasing, the wealthy, who measure their wealth not by what it buys them, but by the disparity between them and the people below them, the wealthy think there's a recession. If the poorer people are getting wealthier, wealthy people think that there's a recession. Wealthy people think the economy is floundering and something needs to be done. And, of course, because they are the wealthy people, the influential people, generally they get what they want. Anyhow, but getting back to the theme of transport, up in Canada now, in the Charlevoix region of Canada, they have this hydrogen-powered train. Hydrogen-powered train. What can you say about it? Quebec will be the very first jurisdiction in the Americas to operate a zero-emission passenger train powered by green hydrogen, demonstrating its leadership in the transition to a low-carbon economy and the establishment of ecosystems devoted to hydrogen. Running this train with passengers on board will allow Alstom and its partners to better assess subsequent steps for the development of hydrogen propulsion technology and its penetration into the North American market. Alstom's Coradia iLint train... iLint? ...will transport travelers on our magnificent railway between Parc de la Chute-Montmorency and the city of Baie-Saint-Paul along the St. Lawrence River, available from Wednesday to Saturday from June 17th to September 30th, 2023. Man, I would almost, if I were going to be anywhere in the area, you know, I'm going to be in Canada, but away on the other side of Canada. If I were going to be anywhere in Canada, I would almost book a ticket on that just for the novelty value, but that is literally all it is. I can tell you right now what the realistic role of hydrogen in future transportation systems is. Very little. Hydrogen is bulky and difficult to handle. In gaseous form, among other things, it diffuses through containers, and it especially diffuses through pipes. You have to have all welded construction of metal pipes to have a hope in hell of holding it. You know, I've mentioned this before, but around here, they've been replacing the natural gas piping with plastic pipelines, which are fine for holding methane. But everybody who says, oh, we'll repurpose the existing gas infrastructure to carry hydrogen. Hydrogen will go through the walls of those pipes as if they weren't there. And there's no gasket material, no joints, no valves that'll hold it. Not very effectively. You have to contend with, you know, you must have all welded metal piping everywhere and seamless tubing. And even so, because of the inevitable need for things like joints and regulators, or valves and regulators, you will have to contend with a serious leak rate. And if you try to handle it as a liquid, well, it's one of the coldest substances known, and that kind of cryogenic engineering is not trivial. But secondly, this is important, it takes 40% as much energy to liquefy it as you can possibly get by oxidizing it. So unless you have an application which generates a whole bunch of waste heat you have no other way of getting rid of, hydrogen is, and it's not just expensive because you have to provide the energy to make the hydrogen, you then also have to provide the energy to liquefy the hydrogen. And don't think that you're going to send liquid hydrogen through pipelines to any distance either. You might be able to get away with it on the moon, where your pipeline can be in vacuum and surrounded by many, many, many layers of something like aluminized mylar. It's multi-layer insulation which prevents radiant heat transfer and has very few points of contact for conductive heat transfer, and there's a vacuum, so there's no convective heat transfer, right? This is the way that you carry liquid hydrogen in pipelines, and it's completely impossible here on Earth, at least without incurring ludicrously high costs. So it's not impossible in principle, but you need to vacuum jacket the liquid hydrogen pipeline, which is its own cost. You have to keep it evacuated, which is its own cost. The maintenance could get to be a nightmare. What happens if you have cavitation? Anyway. But pretty much the only practical form of transportation which could be powered by hydrogen is, of course, the lighter-than-air vehicle, because you can fill it with, partly with helium and partly with hydrogen, and as you go along, you can oxidize the hydrogen, either burn it in engines or use it in fuel cells to produce electricity or whatever you like. Right. You can oxidize the hydrogen. But no. If you are going to be using, you know, there's you know, the hydrocarbon fuels, we continue to use the hydrocarbon fuels because they continue to be very convenient. And, you know, everybody's talking about battery-powered cars, right? Battery electric cars. I even saw something the other day where people saying, car companies shouldn't have electric divisions, they should be all electric. Well, I'll give you a simple gauge for whether or not people believe this. My doctor's office was in what called itself an office tower, only two stories tall, so a very short tower. My doctor's office had to move. The tower was demolished a few weeks ago, and what's been constructed in that spot? You guessed it. A gasoline and diesel filling station for motor vehicles. I can show you another place in town where a gasoline and diesel filling station for motor vehicles has been built within the last year. Now, and there have been some quite large and elaborate ones built in my immediate neighborhood within the last 5 years. There is no sign in that respect that gasoline and diesel road vehicles are going away. If you're if you're buying an office block, and it's not like the office block was empty, it had quite a few tenants. In order to demolish the building and then put in in-ground storage tanks for various grades of motor fuel and build the pump island and the convenience store and all that kind of thing, you're expecting to be in that business for at least 20 years. It doesn't make sense to do it if you think that battery electric cars are proliferating rapidly and will take over the market. And let's face it, there are battery electric cars in my area. If I go out, I go downtown to the post office or whatever I do, going out running errands by car because I have no other choice, I'm likely to see not just the occasional Tesla, several Teslas, right? In the course of half an hour to an hour, I'll cross paths with several Teslas. Those are the most visually obvious ones. There are other makes of electric car, but the Tesla is the one I can most easily pick out of a crowd. In fact, the other day I was on the freeway, stuck in traffic, and I noticed one of those Rivian electric pickup trucks, although it had Illinois plates, so it may have been a visitor from out of state. But yeah, so people who build, own, and operate the infrastructure that makes it feasible to drive fuel-burning cars clearly don't believe that fuel-burning cars are going to lose market share substantially anytime in the foreseeable future. That's worth thinking about, isn't it? And when you look at, you know, electric car chargers, as I've said, you probably need one public charger for every 10 battery electric cars, at least. And then you think about private charging infrastructure. Again, people who don't have private garages to put their cars in are going to have a very difficult time keeping a battery electric car. These are not trivial problems, which is why I continue to say if people are serious about the electrification of transport, you'll know it when they start putting up overhead wires and then laying steel rails. There might be an intermediary period, just as when many U.S. cities were tearing out their streetcar systems in the 1950s, there was an intermediary period where they had trolleybuses, road vehicles powered from overhead wire. Now, there's an argument to be made for battery electric buses. The argument for battery electric buses and battery electric delivery trucks is much better than the argument for battery electric private cars because A, you have fleet maintenance, and B, you have scheduling, right? You can determine in advance how far the vehicle is going between charges. But trolley buses are all right, but again, they continue to tear up the road surface, and really you just have more capacity with streetcars for many reasons. One of the minor ones is demonstrated anytime there's a place in Munich where the streetcar lines, two streetcar lines down the middle of the street, run opposite directions. The streetcars routinely pass each other, and there's probably a foot clearance, right? Probably 30 centimeter clearance between them when they pass. And, well, you can see what that results in, right? You can't realistically do that with most road vehicles. They don't stay to a fixed trajectory that way. Anyway, so think about that for a minute. You know, I mean, the thing is, now, as, you know, the one hydrogen powered form of transport that's even vaguely realistic is lighter than air vehicles, and Quebec and possibly the Canadian Northern Territory, Nunavut and the Northwest Territory, I should say, are very interested in lighter than air vehicles for moving goods and people around in the frozen north, and I saw a news item about a contract being signed with a company in France. But, known as flying whales. But will it happen? That's another question. Right now we've got a very constrained global supply of helium, so all airship projects are having a very difficult time. Partly that's because there's less helium in shale gas, which accounts for more of the production currently. Partly it's because since the 1990s and the demise of the U.S. Strategic Helium Reserve, and the downfall of the USSR, governments haven't been paying natural gas producers to separate the helium from the gas they pump. And so most of the helium that's been drilled for has gone into the atmosphere. I've talked about this before. Anyway, speaking of mining, in Helleland in southwest Norway, a massive deposit of phosphate minerals has been discovered, which is very good news. Well, not just because the world needs phosphates for fertilizer, but because phosphates, as it turns out, are a major component of things like lithium iron phosphate batteries, which happen to be a big technology right now. And this is big news for Europe, because Europe has been lacking in this. But the way they're describing it, it sounds like the deposit is 4,500 meters underground or something, which leads me to wonder how it could possibly be worked other than by breaking up the ore deposit with nuclear explosives. Will the Norwegian government go for that? I have doubts. Anyway, send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. I'll read them when I get back from Manitoba. I'll probably read them on the air. I'll probably send you something in return. Patreon.com/man_Adam, PayPal.